Hi friends, just a reminder that neither Jody nor I are physicians and none of the following should be considered medical advice. Also, in this rapidly developing situation, the best source of information on your community and the regulations and recommendations that apply is your local health department. If you're listening to this in the future, first of all, congratulations on being in the future. Second of all, just know that the beginning of 2020 was a complicated time. Now, please enjoy the theme song by Jonathan Colton. DNA, you're in my heart. DNA. Hi, and welcome to BioBreak, a conversation with your friendly neighborhood biologist. We're into episode 9. I'm still Andy Walsh. I'm joined by my wife, Jody.
Hi there.
And this week we have another special guest with us, our son, Caleb.
Hi.
Caleb, you want to tell the folks anything about yourself?
I like to read. That's about it.
Okay, great. Thanks. So we had your sister on a couple weeks ago, and we thought it would be your turn. This is now our whole family. The cat has made background noise appearances occasionally, but in terms of the humans that live in our house, you've now met everybody. And Caleb, we thought since you like to read and you like to read science fiction stories, among other things, that you might enjoy talking about the science of science fiction stories and how all that works and the interactions between the two. Does that sound good?
Yes.
Did you have a particular story you wanted to start with?
I was thinking Malachandra by C.S. Lewis.
Okay.
It's the first book in the Space Trilogy.
So that's C.S. Lewis's other fiction series, more science fiction compared to his fantasy books about Narnia.
Yeah. And in particular, what's interesting is the spaceship.
Can you tell us a little bit about the plot of the story, and then we can talk about the spaceship, because not everybody's read the book.
Okay. The story is about Dr. Ransom, an English philologist who studies languages.
Okay.
And while wandering the countryside, he runs into an old schoolmate of his who has been working with a respected physicist, I believe, to create a spaceship and establish contact with life on another planet.
Okay.
Ransom ends up being drawn into this plan and is brought over by
I read the book too.
Okay, do you want to fill in some of the details?
He's kidnapped.
Yeah.
They basically kidnap him.
Yes.
And they take him to space.
Yeah.
And they land on the planet Malachandra. Malachandra.
Which turns out to actually be Mars. But it's what the people on Malachandra call it.
Yeah, and they find that the planet's inhabited by like three types of creatures.
Yeah, three creatures.
Yeah. And they kind of rule the planet. And I think one of the things that was the Dr. Ransom, the character Ransom, he has one experience on the planet that is different from the experience that his captors
have. That is very much true. And
so what was it about the spaceship that...
Well, the book was written before we had a good idea of what space travel and space itself was like.
Right. So were there some differences that stood out to you or things that you noticed?
Well, for one thing, the idea of the ship was that it was essentially a big sphere.
Okay.
And they would walk around inside it. They could walk around inside it, and it had oxygen, but it had a very limited supply, so they couldn't really talk or anything.
Interesting. So they thought they were concerned about the ability to bring sufficient oxygen for a long trip.
Yeah.
Okay. When you say they were walking around in the sphere, was it like they were walking around sort of on the inside of the outer shell, or were there like decks and levels? Like,
well, it's specifically like walking around on a sphere inside of a sphere.
Okay. It's almost like
those hamster balls that you can get, use at the beach, but just bigger, right? Where you get inside the hamster ball.
I don't... Sort of like that, but inverted.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so how, you know, so was the sphere designed, did it seem like it was, they thought that would be the most aerodynamic or the most efficient for something else, or is it just different from, trying to make it seem different from terrestrial vehicles?
I think it was very much trying to make it seem different from terrestrial vehicles.
Okay.
I thought it was interesting how they were aware that the orientation of the rooms would change. I don't know if you remember reading that.
Initially, the ship was Initially, the ship had gravity that was consistently towards the planet it was on, but when in space, the natural gravity was just towards the center.
Okay. Was it spinning to generate that gravity, or was there something else?
No, it there was. I think the idea was that there was some sort. Either the idea was that there was some sort of machine, or it was just that it was so dense it would be.
Okay. So there was something in the middle that was creating gravity, either just by naturally having mass or.
Yeah.
Some other artificial thing. Okay, interesting. Because, you know, a lot of times in more recent stories, the notion of artificial gravity, you do have either spherical or sort of circular spacecraft to generate artificial gravity, but the way that they do it is they spin them, and so the gravity is actually going in the opposite direction. What feels like down is actually toward, you know, away from the middle, out.
Yeah.
Outside. That's interesting. Did they talk at all about what about like the thrust or how they got the spaceship into space?
No, there was nothing about that. That said, it does make a certain amount of sense. As I mentioned, Ransom is a philologist, so he might not have been able to understand it.
He had different interests. And Lewis himself was more in that realm of things. Okay.
Now, you've read Jules Verne, right?
Yes.
So, out of curiosity, did you read, you know, Jules Verne wrote a lot of these, you know, stories, like, about technology before we had the technology. Did you see any similarities between how C.S. Lewis constructed his story and how Jules Verne?
I don't think so. The main one... It's been a while since I read, it's been a while since I've read 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I think that's the main one he had that was technology we didn't really have yet. That said, if you remember it, you can
talk. Well, it's been a long time since I read that, and
yeah.
I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a, you know, as with all science fiction, there's a mix of trying to create things which are new and different and seem fantastical or seem futuristic and extrapolating from current technology. And since C.S. Lewis and Jules Verne and H.G. Wells were dealing with similar kinds similar levels of technology, then, you know, I think the parts that they were extrapolating about what things would look like have some similarities in terms of, you know, being a little bit more focused on mechanical technology, less on electronics. You know, I think would be the big difference. I think once we realized all the things that could be accomplished with electronics and integrated circuits and computers, that's a big shift in the kinds of science fiction technology that gets imagined. It's a lot less mechanical and sort of industrial revolution flavored, and a lot more digital revolution.
I actually read something about a book that talks about how there were a lot of science fiction has made a lot of predictions and not all of them have been true.
Mm-hmm.
And one of those was talking about how science fiction really likes to use robots,
mm-hmm.
yet in actual in our own world, we've generally had more luck designing computers.
Right, we've made a lot more progress with software than with hardware or with embodied software.
Yeah. And one of the major effects of that is that older science fiction stories would have people doing hand calculations, or even just, and even if they did use computers, it would only be for partial calculation.
Okay.
Whereas we weren't even able to get into space without heavy computer use.
Right, the actual navigation of the spaceships involved both human-calculated information trajectories and so forth, and also computer-updated
things.
So this might be a silly question, but what is hand calculation? Is that like counting on your fingers, or is that something different?
Hand calculation, I mean, specifically relying... when I said hand calculation, I meant doing calculations by hand.
Like pen to paper
kind of. Yeah.
Okay.
In general, the idea is relying on human power to do math rather than computing power.
Right.
Okay.
Now, do you know what those humans were called?
The first use of computer was, in fact, referring to humans.
That's right. That used to be a job people had, was to be a computer. And they were doing math by hand to calculate all kinds of things. Yeah.
Actually, that reminds me. The book Dune has a similar setup.
Okay. Now, I haven't read Dune, so you're really going to have to help me with that one.
Okay. Dune is set in a far future world, similar to Star Trek, where the idea is that humanity has colonized. However, the main difference from Star Trek is that a few hundred years before the events of Dune itself, there was a big war called the Butlerian Jihad.
Okay.
And this big war was humans trying to get rid of computers that had advanced so far as to be dangerous.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And so in this world, it's most all... the role that would have been filled by computers is generally filled by humans trained to do that.
Okay, interesting. So they've lost trust in computer technology and electronics and are moving back towards human-powered stuff. Interesting.
I think there's a certain amount of religious idea behind it.
Okay, yeah, if it's called a jihad, that suggests a certain element of religious dimension.
Yeah.
And I think I remember there being a lot of religious beliefs affiliated around that, or circling around the spice and its properties.
I should probably explain what spice is.
Please.
So, those of you familiar with Star Wars might notice that the term spice, might remember that in Star Wars, the term spice refers to what would here be called drugs.
Right.
Dune uses the term spice in a similar manner, but in Dune, rather than being explicitly illegal, some varieties of spice are actually major parts of society.
Okay. Like caffeine.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
And one of those is melange, which is supposed to give the user the ability to see into the future.
Okay.
So, obviously a lot of people want that.
Sure. Makes sense. I think a lot of people right now would like to be able to see into the future a little bit.
Yeah. But one of the major things is because of the lack of computers, the interstellar navigators use Melange to see into the future and predict dangers that the ship should avoid.
Interesting. So, focusing on the ways in which our computer models help us to predict the future and trying to replace that more organically, I guess.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm realizing, you know, I was only a little bit older than he was when I read this book. Okay. Like, there's all this stuff that I'm like, I don't remember a lot of it.
Sorry.
No, okay. It's good. Now, you know, this is what happens. Then I go back and I read it again. And
yeah. And where do these substances come from? Are they, like, synthesized in a lab, or are they...
Melange is the big... problem with Melange is that it's created naturally.
Okay.
And it's on it's only created on a specific planet.
Okay.
That planet being Arrakis or Dune.
Okay.
And so control of the planet Arrakis is a major means that the person controlling it has a lot of power.
Okay.
That's where the big conflict is. And that's also where the worms are.
Yes. Okay. And the worms actually have something to do with spice production.
Okay. What is that?
I don't remember exactly, but I definitely remember that the worms seemed attracted to areas of spice.
Okay.
So trying to mine it meant that inevitably they'd have to leave or else be devoured by a giant worm.
Okay. So it's not a biological product. It's mined from the earth, the melange.
Yeah.
But the worms also hang out in the same places. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering if it was like, you know, one of these things, just because I brought up caffeine, you know, caffeine comes from plants and there's a variety of other alkaloids that plants make that have psychological or neurological effects. And they seem to be made by plants as a way of influencing the insects that the plants interact with more regularly, either, you know, because they're pollinating them or because insects are trying to eat the plants or what have you. And so I wondered if this spice was something like that, but it doesn't sound like it.
Dune doesn't really have a lot of plants.
Okay. Well, I didn't know if maybe it was from the worms or something. Yeah. Okay.
What initially made you think of Dune connected with the space travel?
Well, like I said, the whole Mentat thing.
Right, we were talking about computers and how humans used to do calculations and so forth. Yeah. There's also, you haven't seen The Matrix yet, but the connections between humans and computers and potential conflict between the two is a big theme of The Matrix.
I mean, humans, we've written a lot of stories about humans versus computers.
Yeah. So since this is a biology podcast, not that we can't talk about other science topics.
I was to go back to the first book we were talking about.
Okay.
Caleb, what did you think about the biology of Mars?
Well, it's very interesting because there are, of course, three races and they're all very different from each other.
Mm-hmm.
One of the races actually isn't like anything on Earth.
Okay.
Forget what it's called.
That's okay. Do you remember what made them different?
Well, the main thing was that they were very big and very... They're kind of like giraffes in proportion, but they're kind of like humans with giraffe proportions, but even then they're very different.
Okay. The idea being that because gravity on Mars isn't quite as strong, that things can grow bigger?
Possibly. There's certainly a lot of large things early on.
Well, and it seemed like the races, it had a lot to do with where they lived on the planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, the first group that he comes into contact with, they're kind of, like, furry creatures.
The Hrasa.
Yeah. And they live by the water. And that's kind of how I think that's how it's interesting that it's the philologist who starts to figure out the language. And they have a language. And so he, like, looks at his interactions with them as trying to understand and communicate.
And in fact, the whole reason he realizes the Hrasa are sentient is because they appear to be actively trying to say things.
Yeah, and so the other creatures live more in the mountain. I forget the third one. They're little.
They're like frogs, kind
of.
Yeah. I think they were called something like the Fifeltriggy.
Yes, they were very hard to pronounce.
Yes, that was definitely it.
And it talks about these three different beings all have very unique gifts, I guess.
Yeah.
Kind of that it's how they work together, you know, kind of makes, you know, the functioning society. But it was just, I thought it was really interesting kind of reading about what C.S. Lewis imagined the planet Mars to be like, but like reading that with the knowledge of what we already know the planet. So there was like a little bit of kind of cognitive dissonance there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of people have long thought that Mars has life or had life, and even now we're still hopeful that maybe somehow there'd be life on it.
Yeah. So, you know, the current research, I don't think anybody expects to find large humanoid, you know, sentient creatures currently living on Mars.
Yeah.
But there are still possibilities for microbes to live on Mars or to have lived on Mars.
Yeah.
We, you know, as we've understood more about life here on Earth and the different places that microbes can live, even here on Earth, places that we wouldn't necessarily expect.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking last week about bacteria that live in hot springs and can tolerate temperatures of, you know, boiling water.
Yeah.
Essentially. You know, we usually think of boiling water as killing bacteria, and it does for many, but there are some bacteria that have adapted to live in those kinds of conditions.
Fortunately, they're not bacteria we come into contact with a lot.
Correct. You know, and there are bacteria that seem to be able to tolerate the vacuum of space and seem to be able to tolerate the higher levels of radiation in space.
Yeah.
And so the thought is that even though the current terrain of Mars, the current environment of Mars is inhospitable to most forms of life that we're familiar with, it may be the case that Mars, you know, that there are these sort of extreme microbes that can live somewhere there. The most recent thing I read was there was some methane, I'm pretty sure it was methane measurements that they detected, one of the rovers detected. It was a sort of local concentration of methane that was much higher than they expected to detect, which could have a geological explanation or could have a biological explanation.
Yeah.
And that's one of the more exciting or interesting findings.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting how, you know, it's always kind of changing. Like, we think we have figured out where life can be, where and where it can't. And then you find these anomalies that just kind of broaden our understanding of what it really is.
One might even be tempted to say that life finds a way.
I was thinking that. And on a similar note, there later on in Malacandra, there's a part where one of the human scientists who brought Ransom to Malacandra goes on a speech about how humanity has this purpose of destiny that the aliens can't understand.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the parts is him stating that even if humans can't naturally live on other planets, they could be modified to do so.
Okay.
And there's a bit of a discussion of if then they would be truly human.
Yeah, I mean, that's a big conversation. How far can you push the boundaries of human biology and still be human? There's a current of that in, I forget what the individual book now is called, but the Expanse series.
Mm.
The Amazon show is called The Expanse, and the novel series is now referred to by that name. That's not the name of the first book. But it's about a future, since Caleb, you're not familiar, it's about a future where humans have colonized Mars and have colonized some of the asteroids, the asteroid belt, and some of the moons of Jupiter, and I forget how far out exactly they've gone, but humans have expanded out into the solar system and have adapted in certain ways or are developing in different ways because of the different conditions there. And so, for example, the folks that grow up on that are born and grow up on the asteroids and the asteroid belt are much taller because they're growing up under less gravity. And so even if genetically they might not be any different, just sort of the physical constraints on their development are different, and so they grow taller. And, you know, there's an undercurrent of essentially racism
mm-hmm.
between people that have grown up in different parts of the solar system because they have visibly different biology. Are they really, you know, still part of the same group anymore?
I still haven't gotten back into reading that book. At one point, yeah.
There's a lot going on.
Yeah.
The book?
Space fungus and...
I think I mentioned I was reading that book while also reading the prequels to Ender's Game that was talking about. And it's really hard to keep all of those storylines, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
The thing that talk reminded me of was the original Guardians of the Galaxy.
Okay.
Back when they were first created, the idea was that the Guardians were from the future.
Right.
And that the humans of the future would be genetically modified to have different abilities and such to live on different climes, on different planets. And
right. Yeah, so you're talking about from the comic books, there was a team called the Guardians of the Galaxy that wasn't Star-Lord and Rocket and Groot and Gamora and Drax. It was a bunch of different characters. And isn't Charlie 27?
Yeah.
Isn't he one of these genetically modified?
Yeah, he's genetically modified to be more strong and right. Also never mind.
That's okay. He said that was to be able to live on a planet with higher gravity, right?
Yeah.
Like Jupiter, was it? Or I forget.
Probably Jupiter.
Okay. Yeah, you know, I think that is a common question that people have about the future is what does the future of being human look like?
Yeah.
And how much will we tinker with our biology and how much will we supplement our biology with technology? Are we going to wind up cyborgs or genetically engineered?
I think we've already been trying to kind of, you know, wrestle with that just with the Olympics and different... controversial decisions that have come up in the past. I don't know how much you've heard about.
I haven't really heard about it.
Yeah, you know, I think there's been, you know, questions of, you know, for something even as simple as, like, shoes. You know, some of the runners have specialized shoes, and, well, you know, if the shoes really factor in and can make such a big difference in how fast you run... Okay, well, is it really testing your human abilities, or is it testing, you know, Nike's ability to make a good shoe?
Well, there's still a certain amount of human endurance in there.
And that's kind of goes back and forth with the debate of it.
Right. Same thing with the swimming. The bathing suits have changed significantly over the years. And, you know, that when in sports where fractions of a second decide first place from not getting a medal at all, you know, those technologies do become interesting. Or even things like taking your own blood and storing it and then, you know, and oxygenating it and then re-injecting that later on, right? That's all your biology. You're not enhancing yourself with anything external, but you're doing something different than, you know, that other athletes are doing.
I don't think I'd do that.
I mean, that's pretty extreme, but it's a thing that people have explored as a way for sports where endurance is more of an issue. And so at some point, your body, you get into that lactic acid burning cycle where your body is not getting enough oxygen, and so your cells switch to an anaerobic way of generating energy, which as a byproduct generates lactic acid, which causes muscle soreness, and so makes it harder to keep running or biking or swimming in a long distance setting.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so this is a way of trying to get more oxygen circulating in your body for to be able to bike or swim or run longer or something like that. Also, that, you know, we were talking about acid building up in our sourdough starter a couple weeks ago. It's the same kind of idea. The yeast switch to an anaerobic, or the bacteria rather, are switching to an anaerobic way of generating energy, and so as a result, they produce citric acid and acetic acid and so forth that makes the sourdough sour.
Ah.
And it also makes your muscles sour if you were running too long.
We kind of touched a little bit on Life Has a Way in Jurassic Park. Do we want to go there a little bit?
I think that's all right.
Okay. So that's a story instead of computers coming after humans and something from the future coming after humans. It's something from the past coming after humans in a sense.
Yeah.
And I've seen a lot of memes, like tying into our current situation. I've seen some memes going around social media saying, what happened when Jurassic Park opened before we were ready?
Well, yeah, that was, there was a editorial that was basically written as like a PR release from the Jurassic Park management about, sure there are still velociraptors running around, but it's fine. So there's a strong theme there, you know, talking about modifying our human biology potentially in the future. There's a strong notion in the Jurassic Park series of not meddling with biology, that you're not supposed to tinker with life. Do you have any thoughts about that, or about just sort of the biology and the dinosaurs and all?
I mean, on the one hand, that tinkering with biology is dangerous, but they do really try to make sure that it's safe, and there's just a lot of factors they hadn't realized.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think it says something about our ability to understand complex systems, so we can understand things individually in isolation very well, but we don't always understand how they interact. Getting, you know, that touches on the ecological aspects of Mars in Science Trilogy, right? That biology in particular doesn't exist in isolation. Biology is all about the ecology of the system, how things interact with each other.
And that comes up in Dune as well. There's actually a whole thing about how the planet could be transformed by tinkering with the ecology a little to make it more self-sustainable and more and eventually create something that could create a system that would turn it more into something like Earth.
Right, that's a desert-ish planet, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's something people have talked about. What would it take to make Mars? Could we transform Mars into a place that would be more hospitable to to humans or to living things in general. Instead of making ourselves able to adapt to there, could we adapt it to us?
Yeah. Probably be a bit harder than Dune, just because in Dune, at least the planet was already habitable.
Right.
We're just making it nicer.
Right. Also, it's a lot easier to describe something, to write about something in a few paragraphs in a novel than it is to actually make it work in real life.
That is also true. But back to Jurassic Park.
Uh-huh.
That was for you.
Okay. Thanks. No problem.
That's good.
Yeah, so, you know, as a biologist, I always found it interesting the ways in which they tried to bring back the dinosaurs, you know, and this idea of finding dinosaur DNA in, you know, in amber from mosquitoes, and so forth. You know, that it sounds like a cool idea. I was always a little bit confused as to how they came up with the, oh, we'll just throw in some frog DNA in where we need to. I'm not sure how well that would work. I mean, there's, especially, you know, now I think we would probably say throw in some chicken DNA or something like that.
Yeah. And I don't think chickens are very good at doing the change sex thing.
Right. Yeah, so that's a big element of the book, is the way in which reptiles can... reptile development, in terms of whether you become a male or a female reptile, can be temperature dependent.
Yeah.
And so there are ways of adjusting how many males and females result when they thought that they could control, the scientists thought that they could control Jurassic Park by making sure that there was only one sex of any sort of dinosaur.
I think I find it really interesting, the idea that, you know, as scientists are trying to study and learn, you they're always like putting pieces together, but it seems like it could be easy to, if you think about it in the way of like a puzzle. Like, if you think you have all the pieces, well, yeah, you can then assemble the puzzle. But what we're actually doing is we're putting together the pieces, but we're finding all kinds of different pieces as we go, instead of knowing that, you know, so you're always in this kind of situation where you have to, you know, see the problems and figure out the solutions as you're going along. I guess kind of thinking through like Jurassic Park, you know, what? You know, we can look at it like, well, of course the dinosaurs would change and, you know, then be able to, you know, reproduce. But, you know, when the scientists are in the middle of actually trying to do that, it's easy to not see that piece.
Right. You know, so that made me think about, you know, speaking of trying to do science by finding more pieces or whatever, made me think about the findings with soft tissue from dinosaur fossils. Are you familiar at all with that?
Not really, no.
Okay. Not really.
So, you know, the challenge, you know, one of the big issues in the realism of Jurassic Park is that finding that DNA and finding that dinosaur DNA in amber. And you know, we know that DNA in many conditions doesn't survive very long. And doesn't survive over that tens of millions of years. And so there's little expectation that we would actually get dinosaur DNA or any sort of, you know, real organic material from dinosaurs. And, you know, most of the dinosaur fossils are mineralized bones and things. So it's not the actual tissue anymore. It's been replaced by stone over time. But something that has been discovered more recently is that under certain conditions, some amount of soft tissue can be sort of preserved. And it seems to be tied to the ability of iron in the blood to create some chemistry that links different parts of things like proteins together. And so it's not the tissue isn't being preserved exactly intact in the way that it was, but it is being preserved from complete chemical breakdown. And so they've been able to get things out of bones that were, you know, squishy as opposed to hard like a rock. And they've been able to actually even sequence at least some protein fragments from that tissue. So not necessarily the DNA, but certain proteins, particularly some amino acids in the proteins, are more amenable to this iron preservation chemistry. And so the fragments of the proteins around those amino acids seem to be more likely to be preserved. And so they can get little chunks of the sequence and compare them and see that they kind of fall into the overall pattern that we expect, where they're similar to birds in the ways that we would expect phylogenetically. And that, you know, that's a thing that nobody ever really thought to even look for. And so it wasn't part of the puzzle. You know, we thought we had drawn that, we got all the edge pieces, and that wasn't inside those edge pieces. But in reality, you know, that was a piece of the puzzle that that was out there. The picture was bigger than we realized. And some of the early work that was done on that was done by a woman named Mary Schweitzer, who worked in the lab of Jack Horner, who was a paleontologist, who was one of the inspirations for the Jurassic Park characters.
Yeah.
What does it feel like we've said everything that we want to say about,
I think so,
science fiction? I think this is a good conversation. Thanks for joining us, Caleb.
You're welcome.
Maybe we'll do this again sometime.
Okay.
We'd love to have you back.
Yeah.
Yep. And we'd love to hear from anybody else about your favorite science fiction stories and what you think about science and in those stories. You can email us biobreakpod@gmail.com or find us on Twitter @biobreakpod.
And Biobreak on Facebook.
Yep. Feel free to get in touch with any questions about science fiction, any things we talked about this week, or anything in general that you want to ask questions about biology. And we look forward to talking to you next time.
Bye.